All right. Where is Eric? He's usually on time for these things.
Oh, Cam. Oh my God. You won't believe it. I got to tell you something. It's about the future.
Okay. What, do we become assholes or something?
No. You and me, Cam, we turn out fine. But it's the guest, Cam. Something's got to be done about the guest.
What the hell is going on here?
But this is a cool podcast, guys.
What were we watching? What were we watching?
The dolls now.
You did send me back to the future, but I'm back. I'm back from the future. I'm Eric Ambler.
And I'm Old Cam from the future, welcoming you to one of those nostalgic podcasts, but not done very well. Where our only chance to repair the present is in the past, at the point where the timeline skewed into this tangent. In order to put the universe back as we remember it and get back to our reality, we have to examine the pop culture of our youth through the lens of adulthood. It's not about good or bad. The intent is to gain a clearer perception of humanity, our past, our future, the pitfalls, the possibilities, the perils, and the promise. Perhaps an answer to that universal question...
What were we watching in the past? Or the future?
Both.
Read my facts, listeners. This is episode 227, Back to the Future, part 2.
It's about time.
Yes.
That's me describing the movie, so that was my recap.
That's a good recap. You know what else it's about? It's about our good friend, a returning guest. It's Andrew McNally.
Hello. Thank you for having me for this wonderful episode that I can't wait to talk about.
We are excited to have you back. It's been a very long time. I was looking it up. I think Team America was the last time you were on.
I feel like on that episode, we talked about how it had been a long time since the one previous. So I do like 2-3 year breaks, and then I come back in hot.
But for you, it's only a couple days because you've been flying around in the DeLorean.
I was in controlled stasis or whatever he put the dog into.
I just
finished this podcast. This is heavy.
Well, yes, we're continuing our great discussion of this great franchise, Back to the Future, with the sequel, Part 2, which was released on November 22nd, 1989. That was the day before Thanksgiving that year, and the competition was clearing out, getting out of the way. But if you were going to the movies during that holiday break, you might have seen some other films released around then, including The Little Mermaid, Prancer, Harlem Nights, which I included because I believe we all know that poster that used to be in the USC cinema building very
yep.
well.
It popped right into my head right when you said it.
It's the only thing I know about it, just that
but
poster.
Wait, what was that? What was that building called before they renamed it?
Oh, I've forgotten completely.
Who directed this movie, Eric?
Oh, the Robert Zemeckis. Robert Zemeckis.
It was the Zemeckis building.
It was. There's a new Zemeckis in town.
That's right.
On the campus. But I digress. I also want to mention All Dogs Go to Heaven was released just about a week before this movie,
wow.
too. Yeah. Which is an actual episode, even though Cam and I are not part of it, of what were we watching.
I'm going to have to dig into that lore. I don't know how that happened. I have been told that The Little Mermaid was the first movie I was taken to in theaters. This was my nice. Introduction.
Wow.
Introductory weekend around this time.
Cool.
That's all.
That's not.
That's the wrong movie.
You were there. But it means you were there. You were there at the beginning for this movie as well in some way.
Yep.
By osmosis. There are probably people talking about it as your parents carried you back to the car.
Yeah, my mom made sure we had everything. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but she was not shy about putting Back to the Future in front of me, that's for sure.
But as Andrew said, this film was directed by Robert Zemeckis and written by Bob Gale. And it stars Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Leia Thompson, Thomas F. Wilson, and Elizabeth Shue, plus a lot of other famous bit players that I'm sure we'll be talking about. But those are the five kind of main characters, which five main performers, which is really impressive when you think about the scope of this film.
I forgot that this movie is The Clumps.
Yes. Oh, perfect. Perfect comp.
Speaking of Harlem Nights.
Eddie Murphy played Richard Pryor in that movie.
Everything about it was just, yeah, wow.
All right, now that we're kind of established, Cam, why don't you just put in the last piece of the puzzle. Let's remind people what happens with a little recap. Spoilers ahead.
All right, so moments after resolving his time travel dilemma from the last film, Marty McFly is visited by his friend Doc Brown in his DeLorean time machine, stressing that Marty and his girlfriend Jennifer have to come with him to the future to save their kids from a troubling fate. They get in, and the DeLorean takes to the sky, disappearing into the future. This is all witnessed by a dumbfounded Biff Tannen, the former bully and now employee of Marty's father, George. The heroes arrive in the year 2015, where Doc tranquilizes Jennifer and leaves her asleep in an alley, saying that she can't know too much about her own future. Doc then explains that their son, Marty Jr., will be pressured into assisting a robbery with Biff's grandson, Griff, and then arrested, triggering a chain of events that ruin the McFly family. The spitting image of his future son, Marty switches places with him and stands up to Griff, sparking a fight that turns into a hoverboard chase that ends with Griff's gang getting arrested, avoiding Junior's fiasco. Before meeting back up with Doc, Marty purchases a sports almanac covering up to the year 2000, hoping to use it in the past to bet on winning games when he returns to 1985. Doc chastises him for trying to change the past and throws the almanac away, but the elderly Biff has been eavesdropping and retrieves the discarded almanac before following Doc and Marty. Meanwhile, the unconscious Jennifer is identified by police and returned to her and Marty's home, where she awakes and stays hidden while learning all about her future family. As Doc and Marty go to retrieve her, old Biff steals the time machine and then returns it without them knowing. Doc and Marty get Jennifer, return to 1985, who they leave sleeping on her front porch, hoping she'll wake up and believe the time travel adventure was all a dream. Marty then realizes that this is not the 1985 he knows, but a dystopian version in which Biff is one of the world's wealthiest men and married to Marty's mother, Lorraine, his father, George, having died in this timeline. Marty and Doc deduce that the old Biff from 2015 used the time machine to give the sports almanac to his younger self back in 1955 in order to win big at gambling over the years. Marty confronts Biff to learn the exact date he received the almanac, after which Biff tries to kill Marty, just like he murdered George in this timeline. Marty escapes with Doc, and they go back to 1955 to steal the almanac back from young Biff. Marty inconspicuously follows and tries to steal back the almanac, careful not to intervene with his past self's previous visit to 1955. Marty eventually uses the hoverboard he kept from 2015 to chase down Biff and take the almanac. He burns it, restoring the original timeline. But before he can rejoin with Doc, the DeLorean is struck by lightning and disappears. A Western Union courier immediately appears afterwards to give Marty a letter that they've had in their possession for the past 70 years. It's a letter from Doc explaining that the lightning strike sent the time machine back to the year 1885. Marty races back to town to find the 1955 Doc, who has just sent the other Marty back to 1985. Upon seeing this Marty, Doc faints. To be concluded. Cue the trailer for Back to the Future Part 3.
You don't Cowboys. Even have to sit through the credits to see it. You I know. Just see it.
And the audience in the theater saw this back then. What a novel concept.
It's like really whetting the appetite. Like, what? Cowboys? What the hell?
They really wanted to make sure because, you know, I think the next movie was like six months away, maybe.
Yeah.
Filmed simultaneously. So, one probably had to have been the first one to do
Don't
that.
Don't worry, it's coming.
You won't have to wait long, right?
Well, that was magnificent. Thank you, Cam. It was about time, as promised.
It surely was. Yeah.
Many different times. Back and forth and back and forth.
Such a convoluted plot. but like very tight in the same way. Like everything leads into the next thing, and like it all kind of tracks. It was very, it's a very classic screenwriting exercise, I think.
The Bobs knew what they're doing.
You don't make them like that anymore.
That's why they named film schools after him.
That's right. That's right.
The Robert Gale School of Cinema.
Yeah. It's like a Bob Finger sort of scenario where he doesn't get the credit he deserves. Should have been the Zemeckis and Gale building.
Hell yeah. But to kind of ease our way into this, first thing we like to do, Andrew, just give us some background. The first time you remember seeing this movie. And I guess also background just on how you became a fan of Back to the Future in general.
Okay. My mother has always been a huge Michael J. Fox fan. And this was, we had the trilogy box set VHS pack, you know, like the all three of them together. Oh, yeah. And I don't remember the first time, but I remember that, and my parents will definitely back this up, that I watched one of these movies pretty much every day. After school for a good amount of time between like the ages of 8 and 12 and probably beyond, maybe in decreasing frequency, but always a favorite of mine. So, and this one always stood out to me as a kid just because the future was so fun. In my older, wiser years, I think the first one is immaculate and this one is insane, but in a good way. So maybe, you know, soft spot for me for part two, for sure.
I think that's something we've discovered a lot about sequels on this podcast. It's like when you're too young to know, it's just like, this is more and better. Like it tracks with me. I was a fan of the entire trilogy. I spoke a little bit about this on our part one, Back to the Future, part one episode. That they were just always around because my sister was a huge fan and she introduced them to me and we had the tapes and we would watch them. But part two for a long time had to be the one I saw the most because, like you said, the future is fun. And all the shenanigans of Doc and Marty going back in time again to like see themselves and try not to run into themselves. Like,
yeah, really, I think that was really formative for me, that like even at a young age, I appreciated the like, oh, I get to see this scene from like another angle. You know what I mean? Or like what happens after Biff gets knocked out? Like all that stuff like really enthralled me in like a, I don't know, an early sort of like, I guess just nerdy way that like, oh, it's more lore. It's more things happening and I get to see extra of it. It's like, it really appealed to me and that has stuck with me like, throughout. I know all time travel movies are basically ripping this movie off or these movies off, but I don't care because it works for me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, similar to you guys, I gravitated towards the future in this movie when I was very young. I was trying to place it. I probably saw it anywhere between like the age of 4 and 6, maybe even earlier than that, because I think I have a memory of seeing the third one in the theater, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
But maybe I caught up with two afterwards. I don't know. That's because I was so young. I was like 3.
Damn.
But I was obsessed with the hoverboards in this movie. And what I used to do was like, I would take a cardboard box and like rip off the flap because it was like perfectly sized to my feet. And I would like round one side and then like use markers to like decorate it as best as I could to match the Mattel hoverboard from the movie and just like stand on it in my living room, like pretending to ride it like a hoverboard.
Brother, I definitely made a cardboard hoverboard at some point. 100%. I like with the markers and everything. I definitely remember doing that.
That was just like the thing I like thought that this whole movie was. And then like, as I got older, I was like, oh yeah, there's like alternate 1985. And then they go back to, you know, the 50s again. And that tickled my brain also, like in high school, when I was like, ooh, the twistiness of this whole, the timey-wimey time travel mechanics of this movie are so delicious. And
it's like they're challenging themselves.
Yeah, fun's when it gets a little messy. Because like the first one is so like, when you talk about a time travel movie, it's like, this like makes sense in a certain way, kind of. Like it's tight and it follows its own rules. This one is just like,
breaks the rules.
Yeah, a little more loosey-goosey.
If the first one's like a perfect loop, this one's like a Mobius strip. It's like it just twists on itself, yeah. And like, but still somehow comes back around and
and sends you to the Old West in the end.
Well, I don't know. Getting into the conversation, I don't know. We could probably break it up: future, alternate 1985, and
yeah,
1955. If you want, I feel like that's kind of a natural.
It's so perfect. It's so structured.
Structure.
Yeah, it's so right. Yeah, nicely divided for us.
That's yeah. My fetish. perfectly structured movies are my fetish.
Yeah, I remember being so confused by this movie, but like enthralled by the visuals and like and the gags and stuff and like the action mm-hmm. of it. Like it's way more actiony than I really ever realized mm-hmm. until rewatching mm-hmm. it this time. Like Marty's kind of like superhero spy man or like yes. solid snake. It's like stealth movie, yeah. You know? He's so sneaky.
Yeah.
And he's like so good at just even outside of the 55 part, like he's just like very, I know what to do. I'm going to, well, and I can't say yeah. this, but I will say this and I'll let these people know this and not this.
I feel like that's even part of the first movie is that George is really the character who changes the most.
Mm-hmm.
Marty's like just cool from the beginning.
He's just
like,
the cool dude.
Stays cool. And he like, I feel like they kind of had to force an arc with the chicken thing.
Oh my God. The chicken thing. How many
which
times?
Isn't paid off until the next movie,
right?
Really, like he doesn't really learn to get over that until the end of the third one,
right? The
but
hammering.
I feel like because he didn't really have he didn't really have anything as a character,
right?
To go off of. So,
I mean, they did the chicken thing, right, in the first one?
No, they didn't.
None.
No, there's
it's
mostly
so burned
just about
into
him.
My brain as part of his yeah. character, but it right. must be just right. from me watching this movie
it's,
the most.
It's because they hammered it so hard in the sequels, but in the first yeah. one, it's mostly just be like, how do I not be attracted to my mom? Like, that's his main, and like, make sure that they get together, so.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't time to be insecure.
About I do think the first one, like, George kind of has to learn to, you know, stand up for himself and, like, not be negative thinking about himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies to Marty too, because we have the opening scene of the band tryout.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then he kind of comes full circle in the end where he's like, oh, I got time to do a rad guitar solo.
Well, I also think, I mean, I don't want to talk about the first movie too much, although I will.
Yeah.
It's about him like connecting with his father. It's like very father son.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I don't think like in that very brief opening scene of like the loser-esque family that they are, like mm-hmm. you can tell that like Marty doesn't, he like pities his dad and like doesn't really get what he's yeah. about, and then like right. that whole discovery is kind of the doesn't really
it's
pay
true.
Off that well, but I mean it does in this because obviously like he's very yeah. broken up by his alternate father's death.
Yeah, the first movie is very much about learning to see your parents as human beings or as people mm-hmm. too. Like mm-hmm. they had similar experiences that were in some ways similar to yours, and we're all going through it.
Right. Yeah. And this movie is about sports. Or
it's about, yeah, it's about unintended consequences.
Yeah.
It's about gambling.
Yeah.
I do like that. The almanac is like the MacGuffin of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not only is that about sports, but it's used for gambling, which is also a sport of its own, of kind of a game, you know. Mm-hmm.
And what I like about this is, and it's maybe still kind of done in these types of sequels, but like this movie like wrapped up its movie part. And then like a lot of the character part like carries over into the third one
yeah.
that concludes it. But like, the yeah. almanac story is over. That one's done. That's great.
Right,
and
right.
I appreciate that was not drawn out.
Yeah. I think like I like it as a motif. It's like, this is what happens when you gamble with time travel. Like,
right.
These are the consequences Ooh. Of treating it like a game.
The universe always wins.
Yeah.
The hubris.
Yeah, what else about the future do you guys want to talk? Like,
oh man,
the aesthetic is amazing.
So
the utopian
yes.
kind of like
Jaws 19.
Yeah, redressing that famous courthouse set down there at Universal Studios lot.
Oh, I do not envy the set people for this movie. They had to remake a neighborhood and a city in like four different outfits for for different, you know, timelines and time periods. Wow. Incredible.
Part of the, one of the movie's main reasons for being is to like hit all those beats, like those references and like the echoes from the first one. But I love how Marty kind of walks out into 2015 Town Square in the same kind of amazement, an alien sense of wonder that he has as he did in 1955. He's like, what is even going on here?
It should have had like a future techno remix of Mr. Sandman playing when
you hit it. Oh, I always love future music in movies, just like I love future clothes, because it is it's so insane to think, okay, it was only 30 years after like the time of the present, quote unquote, in the first film. It's like, how did we get to this reality where the clothing bears almost no like resemblance or influence from anything that was only 30 years ago? It'd be
I
like
mean, I
us.
Think they were kind of getting it like the 80s are kind of hot right now, so like it's like futurized 80s, which you know, fashion traveling in cycles.
It's like,
I'm sure that actually did happen in 2015.
I mean,
the 80s are cool again.
But well, it's true. I would say that's 80s nostalgia was at its peak in those 2010s. But I'm also talking about the stuff they'll do with like weird angular cuts or like strange like plastic materials. It's like, why would clothes not just still be clothes? Like, it's only 30
it's
years.
It's got to look like the future.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I just love seeing that and pointing it out.
Always a fun angle to like examine of like, okay, we're just going to be wearing hard shells.
Well, watching some like behind the scenes stuff and commentary, listening to commentaries and stuff, it seems like Zemeckis did not, he wasn't really into the future part of this movie. Like he kind of almost begrudgingly had to do it. But one thing I remembered was he's like, the future is always opinion. Like whenever it's depicted, it's always like someone's prediction, and that's less interesting to him, which makes sense because he's such a like precise filmmaker. He likes to like recreate the past in a lot of his movies, like Forrest Gump, for instance. Like, he's all about accuracy. So I could see why he might struggle with like, I don't know, like none of this is going to be true, so like so let's just make it funny. And I think that was like the best approach, and just make it look futuristic.
It's really hard to make something look futuristic if you're not making it that way to like make a point. You know, like so much of sci-fi is like, and futuristic sci-fi is like commentary on the present, essentially. And without that angle, it's really hard to even attempt to be some sort of truth teller or fortune teller in that sense, because you're not really basing it off of anything. It's like, we're just basing it off of the 80s and what, you know, what's popular in the 80s? Jaws. We're going to have Jaws still be around. And like people still love their classic cars, like that
courthouse is a mall.
They get that they, you know, upfit to hovercrafts and everything. Everything's the same, but just like shinier. Which I think is still kind of a funny commentary.
And but also like utopian. I feel like another thing from the, you know, behind the scenes is that they were reacting to stuff like Blade Runner, which was very hot in the 80s and late 80s, you know, dystopian cyberpunk. I feel like this was like an alternative, like, what if we figured it out? What if everything was good? Like, what if we incorporated more nature into that square? There's like water where there wasn't in the 50s or the 80s.
I mean, they figured out de-aging, they figured out the weather, they figured out holograms, holographic movies.
This future reminds me of the future in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Also, like 2 years away from this movie.
Very similar.
Very similar, like 80s, late 80s, early 90s future.
The Dayglo
future.
And
I love it. I like to think they exist in the same universe.
I had the same thought watching people walk around. It's like, hey, this is like the Institute in Bill and Ted 2. But part of the Bob Gale commentary that was interesting was how he described it as a user-friendly future. He's like, yeah, what if we... we wanted the future to be something that people could look forward to, because it's, you know, it's a crowd pleasing movie. But said it's like the place itself is all right, but it's the people who are still messed up in all their human ways. Like, it doesn't just the fact that we have all these conveniences, we figured out all those things that Andrew was listing, like, doesn't mean we fixed ourselves, like, who we are as human beings. And I thought that actually is like the probably the most accurate prediction you could make about our current situation, and probably decades into the future as well. Things will get easier to do, but we'll still be the same kind of flawed human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting in that sense that they made the shittiest part the present.
Yes.
Like the 85 version of hell or whatever they say.
That's right.
Yeah, like, things are bad now, remember? Like, this part over here is supposed to be the fun part. The future can be better. A better world is possible.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I like Griff through this lens, being like pretty like off his rocker. Doc even says something like there's something wrong with him
because bionic implants. His
cybernetic implants made him look crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I do like the way that Thomas F. Wilson plays him.
Oh,
just
my God.
Like, it's like a more exaggerated Biff. It's almost like a parody.
Incredible line readings in that beginning.
Yes. Oh God. Yes.
Act. Holy moly. That's what's burned into my brain is like just the intonations. Like the lines themselves are in my head, but it's like how they are said that like stayed with
Since
me.
When
for...
did you become the physical type?
Right.
Batter up.
Yep. Oh man. Yeah, that like it's just so over the top, cartoonish in a way of like, and I kind of felt that even in the past scenes too. Like it's everything felt like a little bit more heightened than maybe it was. And I don't remember Biff being that frantic. Maybe that's not the right word, but just like vocally acrobatic. Yeah. but maybe it was.
Yeah, this movie to me is the Thomas F. Wilson show. Like,
oh yeah,
the first one is very much the buddy comedy, Doc and Marty. But this is Tommy's time to shine, and he is just as hilarious as those two guys.
Of all the people playing multiple characters in different makeup, he's the one who actually makes them feel like different people.
Yes,
I think even Lorraine, old Lorraine is like not particularly interesting or. I mean, it's alternate, so it doesn't really make much sense, but you know, you don't really know how she got to that point, but it doesn't ring as true. But every version of Biff or Griff or whatever is like so unique and grounded in an interesting way that like, you're like, yeah, it's like, oh, I remember that.
It's almost endearing to see old Biff like getting nostalgic.
Like, just kind of like chuckling with that, yeah.
With it's that a, yeah, sense a very of funny like, sort of progression of like, there's something very familiar all about all this. Yeah. And there's like, I have a flying DeLorean. I haven't seen one of those. And I was like, years. The newer. And he's laughing. He's, like, about it. He's changed. He's changed. He's able to laugh.
Exactly. Biff has actually loved his life.
He lived to a ripe old age.
I like how Biff's monkey wrench into this whole situation is there from the start, like the cold open at the very end, right before the opening credits. What the hell's going on here? Dun! Like just the score, just
yeah. He's been holding on to that since he saw that flying DeLorean, and now he's like, oh,
Biff's gonna cause some trouble here.
Yeah. He lays down the little matchbook thread, like, check out my new matchbooks, which. You know, last scene of the movie, you see it again.
Yeah.
Yep.
Everything is so clearly laid out. You know, we had to hear Doc about like, oh, I just really want to visit the Old West.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's so much part three planting in this movie.
Yeah, just, and it's like... done so just obviously, but like, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't care.
Great flick.
Great flick.
Bulletproof vest.
Yeah, all these things. Like, I guess it was probably pretty mind-blowing at the time that, like, to do a plant and a payoff over two movies in the course of 9 months or whatever the release dates were. Like,
well, the fun of the first movie, the perfection of the first movie is its planting and payoff.
Yeah.
I could see them being like, you think that's cool? Like, what if we did it between two movies?
Yeah, I mean, like the whole idea of time travel is planting and payoff. Like the whole plot is planting and payoff. Like putting it down, like the Western Union thing. Like it was planted back in 1885 and it paid off for this guy when he lost his bet in the rain.
Yeah,
it blends itself so perfectly to just the subject matter of the movie and those two screenwriters, or that I guess one screenwriter. Zemeckis, I think, had a co-writing, but maybe.
It was like story by Bob Gale, Bob Zemeckis.
Yeah.
Both of them. And then the actual screenplay by Bob Gale. But that's what time and time travel is all about. It's seeding something, watching it grow, like, and becoming something like maybe you didn't expect or even predict, which is illustrated very vividly in this movie. Although before we get to alternate 1985, a few more future things that are cool.
We went way deep. It was talking about future.
The whole house that the McFlys live in, which is implied to be kind of like a rundown, like not the best house.
It's but a bad to me,
yeah. But to me as a kid, like it was amazing. Like I wanted to live in this world where I could turn on six different channels at a time, where I could like have like a mini pizza hydrated into a whole pizza in like 7 seconds.
That looks like the worst fucking pizza ever made.
Some movie pizza, yeah.
It's pizza raw green peppers on it.
Yeah,
I'm just laying on top, not even like wilted a little bit.
It is Pizza Hut. It is like the little bag that she carries.
The little hydroponic thing. Like that's an interesting touch.
I was just going to mention, like I wanted that mechanical hydroponic fruit basket.
Fruit
place.
the self-walking dogs. Just like
the user-friendly future. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, the thing of like everybody's has wearables on, like the glasses and even the coat and the like everything like kind of communicates with
the kids at the dinner table with their VR. God, if they only knew.
And you know, NFL Red Zone is pretty much the multi-channel view of 2015 future. So I mean, like a lot of that stuff was, I mean, at least entertainment wise was pretty spot on.
One of
the dumbest but simplest inventions in this movie that I think would be like amazing in real life was when Marty puts on the Marty Jr. disguise and he's got the sleeves that are like too long at first and he just like presses a button and it like shrinks to his size. Like I need that as someone like tall and skinny whose sleeves never fit me. Like I would love just like smart sleeves that know exactly where to stop.
put tailors out of business.
Yep. Yeah.
Just self-altering clothing. And the shoes. Power laces.
The shoes.
All right.
Obviously. Oh, man. It was so ahead of its time that they made them real.
Yes. Same thing, question mark, with hoverboards. Like, I remember when that was coming. Those were coming out, like, around 2015. Like, around the time that this movie depicts. And
I think they shouldn't
wasn't
have been
a coincidence
able to call them that.
I know.
That shouldn't have been allowed.
But they know why.
Oh, they knew. They knew.
They knew what they were doing.
Yeah, I would die for a real hoverboard. And I'm not even a good skater. Like, I would do anything for that.
I have seen, like, fan builds over the years of people, like, making, like, a very rudimentary, like, and it has to be, like, on, like, the cushion of air or whatever, but it is like it's a board that is hovering that you can stand on, like it won't go anywhere, but it is hovering. It's like,
and I'm pretty sure they've done like tests of like actual electromagnetic hovering materials that require a track of some kind but potentially wouldn't if the energy was there, but it's just really hard to like get energy into a superconductor to do that for real for a long period of time.
They can't do that, not unless they got power.
Yeah, I love just the arbitrary rule of like, oh, they didn't work on water.
Yeah,
like, why wouldn't they? What is it missing?
I remember being like fascinated by hover technology at the time, and I remember my brother being like, "Oh no, hover technology exists!" And there was like, he had like a Boy's Life magazine, and one of the ads was like. Like a real life hover craft. It wasn't like a board. It was like a
inflatable
kind of thing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like inflatable
like a rubber dinghy. It, you
know, right. Yeah, exactly. And I was like, that's so amazing. It does exist.
And then you watch a Jackie Chan movie and it plows through.
I was say. Right, Rumble in the Bronx, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Big Finish.
Yeah, it's hovercraft. Out there. You can do it. You just need a lot of power.
The military's got to have a hoverboard somewhere.
I would believe
exists.
It.
Yeah.
We reverse engineered. That's what this podcast is about. Right. What if we reverse engineered some fallen UFO technology?
It's right next to the Iron Man suit that they got hidden away.
I have a question. It's not really about the future, but it's based on something that we see in the future. Griff is Biff's grandson. Mm-hmm. So we're missing a generation in between. Yes. Like, who is Biff's son that's Griff's dad? Like, presumably that would have been Marty's bully, but it's not, because we meet Needles in this movie. Mm-hmm. That's his generation's bully, who's not related to Biff. So I'm very curious who this Biff Jr. is.
Right.
Looking it up in, you know, the Back to the Future wiki, in the animated series, which I guess is not canon, but there is a Biff Jr.
I was going to bring up the animated series at some point, because did anybody watch it? I caught a good amount of it. Yeah, I remember watching it.
Watched it a bit.
I don't remember much about what happens.
Had some of those Happy Meal toys.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Including the hoverboard.
Nice. Yeah, with the
which is a giant cloud.
We talked about this last time. Yeah.
So there is a Biff Jr. I mean, ostensibly. There's some things that they kind of just glide over in this, like some of the stuff.
Well, to me, it's just like, how did Biff, you know, find someone to have a child with? Like, based on the way that he behaves in like 1955, just like, he's just. I mean, I guess that happens in real life too, but
even in 1985, we see him as like the auto detailer, and like, did he just marry late? And like, because he would have been what, like Marty's parents' age, which is probably in their
40s,
late 40s, early mid 40s. So, and it doesn't seem like he's married, or at least it's not implied that he is in that brief time that we see him as his, you know, supposedly true self.
Or even at the beginning when he's like, you know, still bullying George.
Right. Yeah.
All you got from me is light beer.
I feel like in that timeline, he could have been married in a really like gross, I'm a car salesman or whatever he is kind of way. Yeah. But yeah, as a sort of humbled former bully with a mean streak, where's he finding his lady friend?
Who knows? But yes, the eternal mystery of Biff Jr. will always tantalize.
Yeah.
And then, like, how much of an asshole is that guy to, like, raise Griff? Griff is, like, just unhinged.
Oh, my God. I know.
And his little
my theory about, like, why Griff is so exaggerated is that, like, that's how every generation sees the next generation. Yeah. Like, if you ask, like, boomers how millennials are, and millennials how Gen Zers are, it's always like more energy, like more ADHD,
like they talk faster, they like the shorter attention spans, right? Yeah, everything.
I love the callback of the like the shoes untied thing, and it's just like, I'm gonna punch you in the face.
Yeah.
the elevated violence of the next generation. Yeah,
yeah,
you have to use your hands.
It's like a baby's toy.
Baby Elijah Wood.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Also more, you know, Western planting for the next movie.
Yep.
Marty's a crack shot. Yeah.
The cowboy game.
And I love the analog version of that in the third one.
Yep. That game, that arcade game, Wild Gunman, was actually an NES, like, zapper game. It never was an actual arcade game.
I think I remember having that or something, like my cousin had it or something.
Yeah.
Definitely remember that actual thing. It had a little Nintendo flag on the arcade box. A couple fun things I caught in the Cafe 80s. I still don't really understand the Reagan and the who is that other guy?
That's Ayatollah.
That's Ayatollah. Yeah. Okay, that would have been my guess. I don't understand what they were saying. And there are a lot of lines in this movie. I've seen this movie a lot, and there are a lot of lines in this movie that I still just like cannot understand.
I don't know what they're saying. I know it's like a Max Headroom
riff,
which is
like they're parodying that
and amazing glitches and stuff. Yeah.
an amazing yeah. thing to think would survive and endure in the cultural perception. Yeah.
There's a Pac-Man machine in the background, and it has a sign on it that says, like, priceless artifact, do not touch.
Yes. again, it's only 30 years.
Right, right.
It's so funny to me.
The Cubs thing, which I feel like Eric and I would like to touch on. So yes. The Cubs sweep Miami in 2015. And I never noticed that, like, later when they look at the USA Today when it's changing – there's like a little blurb or box score in the top, and it says the Cubs sweep in 5. So yeah. At some point in the 30 years between 85 and 2015, they had expanded the World Series to be 9 games instead right. of 7.
Bloating, which again, a very real That's thing. Great. But the
yeah.
more, add more postseason, just make everything yeah. longer, make everything
if only
bigger.
They had yeah. predicted more wild card spots.
Right? Or even just, you know, the Marlins being in the American League.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like I was getting into this movie when I lived in Miami, but I remember like seeing the Miami part in this movie, mm-hmm. which to Marty is like, oh, that's weird.
There's a team
that Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the guy interrupts him. He doesn't get to say that like Miami doesn't exist. But I remember not thinking it was only weird that it was like, why isn't it a Marlin? It's an alligator. Like,
yeah.
That's not right. That's not the Marlins logo. Like, I was confused. I didn't really realize that, like, they were a new team, mm-hmm. like, brand new to the league at the time.
Right.
So I was just, like, confused all around. Like, why do they have a different mascot? Do they change later? Like,
so much of this went over my head as a kid, and some of it's just being a kid, but like it also just comes yeah. so fast and like
yeah.
moves away yeah. so quickly that like, I mean, it's packed to the brim with gags, especially in this first 30 minutes.
So rich.
And the Cubs won
in 2016.
A year later.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
well, I remember, like it's
close. They were close.
Apocryphal like internet like shitposting stuff, just saying like Back to the Future predicted. Strike. Back to the Future predicted the World Series. It's like not really, but
I remember the Cubs putting something out that like was like, but due to the 1994 strike, the prediction was actually delayed by a year.
It's accurate, yeah.
Nice. So it's accurate, and it was funny. Yeah. I think in 2015 they were playing the Marlins like in the first round or something like that. If I remember,
I read that like the teams like played up the connection
oh, yeah.
during 2015.
Yep.
Yeah. Cause they would have played during the season and I'm sure they did. They mm-hmm. had a Back to the Future Day. Yeah. So fun little story. Like in the end of like 2014, it was the winter time. I was looking for Christmas gifts for my sister and I was like, oh, I know what to do. I went to like an online sports book basically. Cause none of that was, you know, legal.
Put some money down on the Cubbies?
I put some money on the Cubbies.
Hey.
And I gave it to her as a gift. I was like, here's the bet.
That's amazing.
And it, you know, it came closer than I thought it would.
Yeah. Should just let it ride next year.
That's, I know, right? Now I'm kicking myself.
1,000-to-1 shot.
Yeah.
Well, who is that guy and why is he in so much makeup?
So
is
that
supposed to be a must have
been the guy from the last movie.
No,
that was like trying to save the clock tower.
No, yeah. Well, that was a lady.
It was a woman, like, yeah. The first one
with the can. That is Charles Fleischer, who is the voice of Roger Rabbit, and you know Robert Zemeckis' movie just prior to the Back to the Future
yeah.
sequels.
Why did they have to make him old?
Because he comes back. He's also the mechanic in 1955 who is you know repairing Bill's car after the manure gets dumped on it.
Whoa! Know,
this is very recent discovery.
Things.
Yeah, this
still
was like
finding things.
This watch I was reading and I found that out. I'm like, oh, you can almost hear a little bit of Roger Rabbit in his voice as an old man.
I'm gonna go watch it again and listen a little closer. I didn't. Yeah, you never really get a close up of that mechanic. So like, I didn't not put that together ever.
Yeah.
And like, why would anyone? So like, he's still alive in.
Yeah, apparently.
2015, he's yeah. supposed to be like the same dude and he's doing this now. Okay. Wow. Never thought I could learn anything new about this movie. That's crazy.
Gotta love it.
The digs at Spielberg are really good. Shark still looks fake.
Although this one's directed by Max Spielberg, Jaws 19.
Yes, I did catch that this time, yeah.
Yeah, what are we doing? We have 15 Jaws movies to make.
Yeah, we got to pick up the pace. Well, we're already behind. It's 2024.
And we're almost 10 years later. So there should be like 25 Jaws movies by now.
Yeah. Oh, faxes just still being a thing.
Right.
Couldn't like, conceive of anything else in that point.
Like, even in the world with video phone, too, it's like we have FaceTime. But we are still sending faxes, which is a very, you know what, in Japan, they still do. And
really?
That plays into something I was going to say. It was like this movie made during the time when we thought Japanese influence was going to be something that lasted forever and was like going to remain prevalent in American life. And it did not.
Like, yeah, that's kind of an angle I never considered either. Of like,
it's like Marty's boss is Japanese. He works for a Japanese corporation.
Yeah. Another thing that was a little bit glossed over that I wonder if there was some backstory or deleted scene or something, and maybe you guys know, when they're asking about like where Jennifer is, like old Jennifer, and he's like, I don't know, I can't really keep track of her anymore. Like, is there something going on there that like was meant to be larger or something that like didn't end up getting fleshed out? Like, that was such a weird, like, I guess it just implies that like they're not happy in their marriage and it's not as as fabulous as Jennifer would have hoped.
There are cracks in the foundation, the kind of stuff that would push Marty into the wrong crowd. Marty Jr. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Fair enough. That explains enough.
Marty Sr. is pretty depressed, it seems. You know,
he is like very kind of threw dejectedly his life away. Strumming his guitar.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, we didn't even talk about the elephant in the room of fake Crispin Glover upside down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're right.
Such a, again with the line readings so insanely over the top, like just don't give him that many lines, he doesn't have to say that much.
But Crispin Glover is such a specific performance that I feel like that guy felt like he had to do a Crispin Glover impression.
Well, thanks to this movie, I mean the lawsuit that came out of this movie may end up being what saves us from AI anything. So thank God for Crispin Glover.
Thank you again, Back to the Future.
Yes.
It's a real shame that he didn't want to do it, or he asked for too much, I guess.
Crazy. That could have been a really fun angle of like everybody else getting in makeup and doing silly stuff.
I know.
Like that would have been really fun.
Like what if he played Marty Jr.? I guess they wouldn't have had Marty Sr. just
replace
be the spitting image, but I feel like they would have found fun things for George to do.
Yeah, considering he was, you know, the arguably the second main character of the first movie, just to not have him in the movie at all, basically, I mean, is a missed opportunity. He could have not a missed opportunity. It's shit happened, but
what if he was playing the daughter in drag?
That, oh my God. And you know, I didn't really realize that was Michael J. Fox when I was a kid.
Yeah, no.
Like, it was pretty good. The ADR was bad, but the
Mom?
The look was
Mom,
good.
Is that you?
That was good.
Just the way that he'll look directly into the camera, like during the first close up, it's like, we really want you to notice. Like, think twice.
Yeah.
Who could this be?
Pass and pass again.
Yeah.
Texaco, also, of all the gas stations. The one that like didn't last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some missed opportunities with brands. Pepsi being dominant. Mm. But they were always Pepsi in this movie. I feel like that was built, baked in.
That was in the first one.
You want a Pepsi, pal, you gotta pay for it.
Yeah, Pepsi.
So this in the future it's Pepsi Perfect, which I guess they did do back in 2015. They did like a
mock-up.
A Pepsi Perfect mock-up and sold some, I guess.
I'm still confounded by that bottle and how it works. Mm. Couldn't figure it out.
It looks kind of like a modern water bottle, like, you know, with the screw on top.
Yeah.
Is it just like a screw off, or I don't know. That's which I think also like is me. Maybe a callback to like how Marty couldn't open the bottle in 1955 in the first one, and he's like, it changed like, again, and it's like, I can't figure it out again.
Which, what a universal experience, you know, as time goes on. I used to be with it, then they changed what it was.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And now what's it seems weird and scary to me.
Yeah. It's going to happen to us again. All right. Well, Biff steals the time machine. And yep. I think so many good, like, we did it. And then, like, oh, no, we didn't moments in this.
More peril. More complications.
I'm curious, like, once they go back to 85, like, they have to, like, drive around the town a little bit between the places that they're going. Although Hill Valley does seem pretty small, mm-hmm. just from the based mm-hmm. on the fact of, like, Marty running and skating everywhere. But
it also seems like middle of the night, so, like,
there's not enough
activity to, like, yeah. really notice the big differences.
The amount of bombed out cars, a tip. There's so many just, like, fucked up cars.
Fallujah, where are we?
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, it's way over the top in a really delightful way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember bars being on these windows.
Just observation maybe. So this is a movie that's made in 1989, or released in 1989. The late 80s, I feel like it has the perspective to criticize the 80s in a way that the first movie didn't.
Right.
Because the first movie was like in the thick of the 80s, mid-80s, 1985. It's like, look how fun the 80s are. And I think this one is a little can afford to be a little more cynical about the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
So like this 1985A is like everything wrong with the 80s.
Yeah. I think that, like I was saying with the... like the commentary on the present being within the sci-fi, it definitely feels that way of like, oh, we're just going to deregulation and legalize gambling and just
right. Donald Trump. Know, and
yeah. Just wealth run amok and running the cops and everything. And it felt very pointed in that way this time around, especially this time around for me.
Oh yeah. Corporate degradation of society by corporations. Like, the thing I key on more now is how the father isn't just angry that there's a grown man in his teenage daughter's bedroom, but he like thinks it's someone sent by the bank to like pressure them, pressure them into selling their house. And as Marty like takes off down the street, every other house has a for sale sign. It's like, what is going on here?
I noticed a lot of really interesting like neighborhood stuff of like, you know, Hilldale being like this idyllic, like, oh man, I can't believe I live in Hilldale in the future, like from the 1985 perspective. But like in 2015, it's like has become run down and like a bad part of town. Like there's a lot of like turnover in like Hill Valley itself that I found very interesting in a very, very lightly political way.
Uh-huh.
It was just very subtly snuck in. And that bank line is kind of the same thing. You know, we see Lion Estates, like their neighborhood being built in the 50s, and it's supposed to be like the hot new neighborhood or whatever, you know, like the fancy new neighborhood. And then by 1985, it's also like, you know, where the lower middle class lives. Yeah, yeah. It's there's a little bit of commentary in there, just a little.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of it, though, in Biff and the Pleasure Paradise and the Biff Tannen Museum.
Land
for redneck bikers.
All the bikers. I feel like mad great great grandfather, Mad Dog
Buford, Mad Dog
Buford, yeah. Mad Dog,
the fastest gun in the West.
Just plant those seeds.
And you know, I'm pretty sure Bob Gale has come out and said, like, yes, Trump was definitely an inspiration for 85 Biff Tannen.
The painting of Biff Tannen in the background of his like penthouse suite is based on a specific Trump painting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That glowering,
which looks
portrait.
Very much like his presidential portrait.
Yeah. Just scowling.
This is the teenage boy in me, but the painting that stuck out always for me was when Lorraine is on the steps and it's just that like pin-up, like 80s pinup babe with like the Kelly Kapowski hair.
Yep. Bronze
right
tan.
Behind her. Yeah. It's just decorate your house that way.
Yes, the gilded penthouse. And oh my god, so this is a connection to a different movie, but I just this past Christmas we were watching It's a Wonderful Life as per tradition, and I think one of my, I think it was my mom, one of my parents saying how in the fantasy sequence where George Bailey, like, I wish I had never been born. And then he sees it and towns are horrible. My mom's like, now how could like one person not being around make things that terrible? Like, how could the town get that bad? And I gave her two examples. I said, well, you know, this is what happens when people don't have someone decent to look up to or believe in. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, think of Donald Trump. And then I said, think of Biff Tannen from Back to the Future Part 2.
Without George McFly.
Exactly.
Being alive in that timeline.
He didn't counterbalance it. They didn't have McFlys there to stop him.
The eternal battle of the Tannens and the McFlys.
I know, this is like a carnival type situation.
Very much so, yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, I get it. It's like they conceded the point. Like, yes, I understand now the degradation that can occur when you don't have that example of decency.
Mm-hmm. I like the detail that, like, pretty much every outdoor shot has, like, factories in the background.
Belching smoke.
Pollution, yeah. Spewing, yeah, like factories.
BIFCO.
Yeah,
BIFCO. Yeah,
Simpsons ass name.
Yeah. Well, and like toxic waste removal site or whatever, right. Like, you know,
yeah.
Very
yeah,
Simpsons.
I'd never read really clocked before either, but that little like pan over to that toxic mm-hmm. waste solutions, whatever store that like is sparking and smoking.
Yeah. Man, I feel like the background of these movies, the whole trilogy, like there's such immaculate attention to detail mm. with the background, mm-hmm. especially with like characters eavesdropping in the background. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed. This should be Robert Zemeckis' like claim to fame. Just the attention to detail and the mise-en-scène of like
just the blocking
things going on and all yeah blocking all kinds of things in every plane of the frame.
Totally.
Like there's always like three planes going on at this, especially in the 50s.
Yep.
As we'll see, it's so we have like Marty spying on himself and also old Biff spying on them. It's like there's three planes, and I'm like amazed mm-hmm. at that attention to detail. And that plays into like the background gags, the industry in the background of every shot. Mm-hmm.
It's what you get when you shoot on a lot.
Yeah, they just sprinkle so many things into mm-hmm. every visual plane.
It's
that we're
so
seeing.
Dense. There's so, so cool. Much in every frame.
Yes.
I mean, even just kind of, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, but like the idea, like when he finds the Ooh La La magazine and like seeing Lorraine and George in the background, like through the window, like makes perfect sense. Like mm-hmm. it all just like the sense of space is there for me that like that's where Strickland watches the parking lot because that's where the kids go to drink liquor and smoke cigarettes. Of course, like that makes perfect sense. I wonder what Strickland's life was like in the alternate 85 a lot. Like, he's not working at the school, and he is strapped to the gills. Like, what is he doing?
He clearly just roams the wasteland looking for fuel.
Mad Max level.
Looking
and
for
that
the juice.
Drive-by. So scary, that drive-by. It's so intense.
Hey, Strickland!
It wasn't until like 2 days ago that I've learned that is not Donald Pleasance. I thought that was Donald Pleasance for like years.
That'd be amazing.
He looks so much like him.
He's very the baldness, the shininess. He is bigger though, like taller and more physically imposing. I'm trying to look for his name now. Where is he?
I looked at it in the credits and it escapes me now. But I love that he's a character that recurs to throughout
James Tolkien.
That's it, yeah.
Throughout the McFly Tannen timeline, there's always a Strickland, mm-hmm. which I think is pretty cool. So one thing that occurred to me, like the question always gets asked of like, why are Doc and Marty friends? And I feel like this movie kind of maybe could answer it. Or I guess it's just the first one, right? Like, the whole timeline of like him meeting him in the past, like would he have sought him out in the future? Mm. Like when he's there and like they strike up a friendship. And so Doc knew the whole time that he had to, but not really, because the timeline doesn't really work that way because it like changes itself. So there's a reason within this that they were friends that does not have to do with time travel, but like,
because he had a really big amp that he let Marty use.
That's it. That's what it was. Yeah. Started hanging around with the guy with the cool toys. Yeah. Doesn't matter if he's old, he's got cool toys.
Could have been an after school program, you know, where they pair students with elderly people.
So hard to figure out what Doc's reputation is ever.
Right. Like, yeah. What's his job?
In the 50s, he's a crackpot, but he's like not broke. And then like in the 80s, he's even weirder. And then like the paper changes to being commended instead of committed. And like, so he's respected in a certain way. It's like, I have no idea who likes this man.
Yeah, true.
I feel like Christopher Lloyd plays it in such a way that he throws like some ambiguity into it all. Like in our episode about the first movie, I had this whole theory that like, he's aware of everything. He like remembers the timeline. He knows that he's supposed to like send Marty back to the future and in the future. And I feel like he plays it everything in such a way that like, he might know so much. Like he flies into this movie. Like he presumably he's already been time traveling for a while. Like, yeah, we don't know how many time travel adventures. Yeah. He knows he's got like currency from like a bunch of different timelines already. Mm-hmm. And when that great moment when Marty's like, what do we become assholes in the future or something? And he pauses. He's like, he has to think about it. Like, what am I supposed to say? Like, it almost feels like he's like, how do I not reveal too much of what I already know? I love Christopher Lloyd in these movies and just, I don't know. Like the way he plays it, I feel like leaves wiggle room for so many questions and implications and theories.
I think even what I was just saying could still be true, that like he does remember the timeline that he has to do this thing with Marty. But like the only thing he doesn't know is the bulletproof vest thing that like, cause he didn't open the letter until that moment, I guess. But like from the 50s until 1985, like he knew he would find this kid Marty and have to help him get back to the past, to help him get back to the future, because he did that. You know, he's already working in paradoxes before you know the movie's even started.
My low effort explanation is he's done so much he's forgotten half of it. Like he's been traveling around so much, and he's like, his mind is preoccupied with challenges like the total destruction of the universe, you know, like he can't remember like he can't remember that, like, oh, let's make sure to lock the DeLorean when we go see Marty's future house, you know.
And I wonder if like there's even something that he's not saying, that like, you know, he wants to use the time travel for exploration of this humanity or whatever the explanation he gives. But like, also he's using it to like make sure his friend doesn't fuck up his life. Like, does that lead to like nuclear holocaust or something? Like, is that chain into something worse that he's just not saying?
Right. Yeah, that's something that I am curious about, because you know the whole previous movie, he's like, don't interfere with the past. Like, we can't know too much about our own future. But then in the end of that movie, he's like, ah, what the hell? So presumably, he doesn't have those qualms anymore as much.
Right.
And the whole catalyst of this movie is we have to change the future. I guess he hasn't quite learned that, like, the future is what you make of it. His, you know, the wisdom he imparts in the third one. So he's still making those mistakes here.
When you're unstuck in time like that for that long, it almost becomes like, what is the future and the past? Like, it's all the same. Or, you know, it's all influencing each other in subtle ways.
To me, it's like he has made this friend who is essentially family now, and he cares about the well-being of this family, the McFly family.
Did he look him up in 30 years? Because it's, you know, you never see him and old Marty interact or talk or conceivably he is the same, you know, the same dude that he would be talking to. We never find out.
Alas. I do want to give a shout out to the chalkboard in 1985, where Doc is explaining to whole generations the concept of, you know, non-linear time branching, paradoxes, branching
alternate
timelines.
Man, the three lines on a board.
Yep,
it's that simple.
Yeah, but now we're all, we've got spaghetti and the Flash, and we're going in all kinds of crazy directions. Like, no, that's all we needed. That was it. The timeline skewed.
I loved seeing the Back to the Future kind of time travel logic return in Looper. How, you know,
I haven't watched that movie since it came out. I gotta watch that again.
It's pretty much like a more advanced version of like Marty disappearing in the first movie, like as things are currently happening in the past. I don't know. That's the closest and then Endgame, which
I was gonna say,
says,
Endgame
like,
just
this
does
is,
it again.
This is Back to the Future. They like outright meta explain that it is Back to the Future.
Directly influenced, yes. Both in the movie and outside of it.
For better or worse. I think it's fun.
Yeah, I liked it.
Oh, yeah.
It might be my favorite part because I'm like, Back to the Future.
I don't want
to
get canceled from this podcast by saying Endgame was all right.
Endgame's awesome. I love
you
Endgame.
You guys are friendly to it.
Yeah.
I know some people out there that won't like that opinion.
Oh, my.
Every time I watch it, I'm like, man, this slaps.
I'll give that one another go, too. I've watched it a couple times since the theater.
It slaps like Biff's three goons, who are the same guys from high school.
The easy way.
The easy way.
What? And even that choice. Why is that? Why did they make that choice? Who's saying that line? It's just funny. It's like this movie is just action comedy. I'm just so
Billy Zane with the redneck accent. Sonny, we can do this.
We can do this the easy way
or the hard way.
Oh, why? Yeah, why did he do that? When did he become that way? What was the story there?
Why does anyone skew conservative in their older age? We don't know.
Fair point.
And
going back to It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Filmmakers in the commentaries talking about Back to the Future is basically like a Capra movie.
Mm-hmm. I see it.
Franchise.
I see it.
Which I like. Totally. I see that. And also A Christmas Carol. They mention like Capra, It's a Wonderful Life and Christmas Carol both being like essentially time travel stories. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was evoked in the George gravestone scene. Mm-hmm. When Marty sees George's gravestone, he's like, oh no, this is like the darkest possible vision of a future.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Big Christmas Carol vibes there.
Yeah. How do I avoid this dark future?
And credit to Zemeckis in that scene, too, because all the rest of it is so cartoony, and that scene still packs a punch, like with the soundtrack and the
I was going to say, the Silvestri bringing in that new, like, like foreboding Back to the Future.
The dark timeline song, yeah.
Yeah, the darkest timeline theme. God, so good.
Michael J. Fox gets to flex a little bit. I mean, he flexes through this whole thing. The athleticism and the dropping down to those steps in the 50s and just being like, cat. Like, that match, that move always, like, onto a set of stairs.
How do you
just,
do
like,
that?
Always blew me away.
I mean, I'm sure it's a stunt double, but I always love, like, his dive over Biff's couch in the penthouse when Biff starts shooting at him.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you were saying.
Very much a stunt double.
It was like you were saying. He turns into, he's like, action spy man in this movie.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you did
avoids all the bullets?
Did he join the gymnastics squad or something? What happened?
He's got this very like stumbly body language throughout a lot of these movies, like stumbling through the cemetery, or like anytime he's, you know, stumbling into the 50s, stumbling into 2015. He's always like
doing his recon,
almost getting hit by cars and like running into people.
And I love the reflection of that in Marty Jr. too, who's like even more bumbling. Like again, the next generation.
What
just
a goof!
Doing it more. Yeah,
it's genetic in the McFlys,
right? Yeah. It kind of is. I mean, based on the movies.
I thought a fun detail on the gravestone, going back to that, was George was born on April 1st.
Ah.
He's been a joke since birth.
Aww. Poor George. Man, I feel like we could talk about the 50s for even longer than we've talked about these other parts. It's such a madcap
ramps it up
chase sequence that is so well executed.
Yes, the 50s. Man, I feel like there's just like this, the stages to this movie are so, they tickle my brain in such a fun way. Mm-hmm. Like the future, that's fun. The alternate timeline, that's like another
what if
thought experiment. Yeah. And then the 50s again, when this movie flips back into the first movie and like comments on, observes the first movie from an outside perspective, mm-hmm. altering moments from the first movie, like were they there the whole time? Like it's just so fun to think about in retrospect.
To the point where people like claim in the original movie they can see like there's like someone in a dark jacket in the background. That's totally Marty.
Yeah. That would be something,
right?
I love that every time Doc says like don't come in contact with your past self or your future self, like Jennifer does it and then Doc does it and then Marty gets hit in the face with the door. Could be catastrophic. Yeah, just got like, beamed in the face,
or you could just pass out. It's like always like it's always on the lower end of the spectrum.
It's never the worst worst possible scenario.
Could be localized just to our own galaxy, which is that's a relief. I like how, you know, in the first movie they have like we got to get this done in a week, and then like, you know, to make this movie even more madcap, it's like you're going back on the day. Like you've got one day to do this, which I always thought was cool.
I mean, the crazy part thinking about it that like I never really clocked as a youngster either is that like, what, I mean, it's alluded to that. Like, I feel like I was just here and like, yeah, you were.
Yeah.
And like,
Marty's like, I was here yesterday. And he's like, yeah, you were.
That's nuts. Think,
yeah. Cause the adventure in 2015 doesn't take that long. It's like half a day, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I set her down at night. He goes back to 85 at night. I feel like there is some time that passes there. Cause they go to the grave and then he goes back to Biff. Like that's must be at least somewhat later. It could be just very late at night.
Yeah.
I guess it is late at night cause it's night again and we don't see any of the day. And then just like packing it all in to November 12th, just,
I like the line when they're going back to 1955, he's like, unbelievable that old Biff could have chosen that particular date.
Yeah.
It can mean that point in time inherently contains some sort of cosmic significance, almost as if there were a temporal junction point for the entire space-time continuum. On the other hand, it could just be an amazing coincidence.
And wouldn't you never know? You never find out.
Yeah.
What a fun... Well, how much fun did they have writing this movie?
I like to think that he picked that day because that was the day that everything went to shit for him. It's like, that's the day that guy punched me. I feel like everything was downhill from there.
It's after...
Literally into shit. It's
after he had literal shit poured on him.
Yeah.
I remember that. But yeah, it's such a fun, cool game of cat and mouse with just getting the almanac. I always forget how Marty is basically like, he tracks him down pretty quick and then just spends all day like hiding in his car or like infiltrating the dance.
It's always just out of reach. Like it's always like pulled away from
so
him at the last second.
Every
like,
time, yeah. And then he has it and then he loses it.
Yeah. In the commentary, they talk about it being Hitchcockian. And I can see that just like
the MacGuffin.
Making such a big moment out of like, oh, it's right there. No, like you just missed it.
And it just escalates so nicely. Yeah. Just all the little steps towards it. And then finally the amazing flip over the car.
Yes.
Being carried off
with
into
the hoverboard.
Sky. Yeah.
So I want to talk about Marty's final look in this movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he comes from the 80s in the beginning. So he's just like his normal like red t-shirt, jeans, Nikes, whatever he's wearing. He acquires the hoverboard in the future. And then in the 50s, his inconspicuous outfit is like the leather jacket,
dressed like Fonzie,
the fedora, the fedora, the Ray-Bans. I feel like, you know, he didn't really get to wear anything like that in the first movie. He's kind of like, he kind of had to wear the like dorky 50s outfit, but I feel like this is like perfectly synthesized peak Marty, like peak time traveling Marty, where he's like, he's got the future accessory and he's got the cool, the coolest version of the 50s. Yeah. And he's the most complete version of himself, and that's who is able to like overcome this time travel paradox.
Yeah, he's also a like 17-year-old kid, and he just got given $100 that goes like so far in 1955. And he gets to pick what he gets to wear.
Yeah,
it's like, what would I like? This is cool.
Fun detail: the novelization of Back to the Future Part Two describes that outfit as a Marlon Brando type leather jacket and a real Frank Sinatra pork pie hat and a pair of sunglasses. So that's like that was. And that's like his inner monologue. So it's like what's running through his head is like, how should I look in the 50s? He just thinks of celebrities.
Yeah. As he would.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite line from this entire movie is one of my top lines of all time that I still say as often as possible. Is this your ball? You want your ball? Go get it. Every opportunity I can.
Do you have a dog to say that to?
Yeah, we do. Oh yeah, you said the Thomas Wilson show, like incredible,
right?
Incredible character building of like, this guy is an asshole.
Even the way he throws the ball, like nails it, like right where it needs to go.
Yeah,
inside the, you know, on the roof of that house in one take. He's like, yeah. No stunt double the there.
Kids are just silent. Yeah. They stop. They're just like, and then they're gone.
Or him like yelling at his unseen grandma.
Voiced by Thomas Wilson.
Nice.
What I learned from the credits this time around. Like, he is killing it.
You're amazing.
Biff! Where are you going now?
Where are you going now?
Turn off the camera. Get home when I get home.
Trumpy 1985 Biff line that I didn't call out when we were talking about the alternate timeline. Mm. Two McFlys with the same gun.
So, yeah, ominous. Very, very well read. The same gun. So over the top.
I keep waiting for someone I know to go to Switzerland so I can say to them, you're supposed to be in Switzerland, you little son of a bitch.
Very elegant to have Doc and Marty out of the picture in 85. Just like, we're not going to deal with that right now. We're not going to do that bit twice.
I just want to say one thing. God bless America. I could go on and on about it. I'm going backwards into 1985, Biff.
We're traveling back in time to the earlier in this
55
podcast.
55 Biff is like, he's so great because it just like underscores how dumb he is and like how he does get smarter over the course of his life, but like like he just really started from a bad place. You can see.
Yeah, and I like that idea of like, we're all dumb when we were kids. We can change a little bit.
Yeah, it's almost endearing to see like old Biff recognize how dumb he used to be.
Yeah, and I think
you're really frustrated by it.
It's leave.
Yeah,
sound like a damn fool. Someone finally told me when I was 59 years old that I'm saying it wrong, and you sound dumb. Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at when I was talking about him playing the different characters, and he is the only real one that like gets to play off of himself and play with that a little bit. But like, you see where he has gone, and those two guys are very different guys. But like, you know, they can still start the car, they still call people butthead, but like, there's a wisdom that he imparts to old Biff that is admirable and really makes young Biff, like you were saying, kind of a pitiable character, because we just see him being awful and like the nasty shit that he says to Lorraine on the street before he meets old Biff. Yeah. So gross. And he like just listen to the old man. Just listen to the old man. If you could go back in time and tell yourself one thing, what would it be? It's leave. Make like a tree and leave. That's the one thing.
I also like how Biff is, young Biff is so dumb. Like, he doesn't understand, like, no, UCLA could kick a field goal and just win this game. He's like, what do you mean, old man? He said the game's over. Like,
yeah, you don't understand editorializing in sports commentary. Yeah. Come on, man. You lost. He said the game's over. Yeah. What timing, too, to be able to turn on the radio and just have that last little bit to demonstrate your point. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Perfectly planned by old Biff.
Yep. It's all timed out to perfection.
I was thinking, and it was actually said as much in the commentary, of how that almanac, in reality, it would be, if it covers like 50 years of sports statistics, of sports, it would be,
yeah,
it would be like an encyclopedia.
How how it all fits in there.
And that's like a college game, too. Yeah. It's not like the pros or anything.
Every college football game, every major sporting event, every horse race. Like, of all the things you're recording, unless it's like the major ones, I guess, which maybe it was.
Print gets really tiny in the future.
Yeah. It's like, man, what a boring book. It's just a bunch of numbers.
There's a bunch of QR codes you can scan.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it just directs you to a website.
Read this. Is this a language in the future?
It's barcodes.
We didn't mention the Dustbuster bit. Like, the whole selling point of the almanac is not the contents inside, but it has a dust jacket. Yeah. And if you like dust.
It's before they invented dust repellent paper.
Right.
Right.
The dust is the artifact here. Nothing else about it.
The world used to be so dirty.
Again, the scheming that is innate in these characters, of like old Biff knowing that you can't let anybody know you have it. You just learned what time travel is, basically. And you're already like, I have the perfect plan.
Right. And if a crazy old man or a young kid ever come looking for it, kill
Which
him.
Is weird, because he knows their names, right?
Right.
Like, couldn't he just say who they are? Like, Marty McFly, you're going to know him. Just get rid of him.
Did Biff ever meet Doc Brown? Well, I guess in the alternate version, he has him committed, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess, yeah, maybe. Well, I don't know. If you look at it from, like, the original 85 timeline where he's the car washer, like, he knows Marty.
Right.
And then I feel like they all kind of know that he hangs around with Doc Brown, but. You know, this is picking nits.
Yep.
Who cares? Have fun. Just enjoy the movie.
Just a question. I was curious. Like, I wonder if those guys have ever met.
I don't think. Yeah, I guess they never actually have come into contact. But Doc lies so low in the first one and in this one. Yeah. Like, he doesn't really.
Doc is known as Strickland, which always tickled me. That, like, you're a slacker, McFly. Always hanging around with that Doc Brown.
Maybe they know each other from their past. They're similar
ages. They're classmates.
Yeah.
Maybe Strickland was Doc's Biff.
Oh my God.
Ooh.
Now there's a pitch.
We're getting ahead of ourselves now. I like that.
One of my favorite bit parts in the movie is the guy who's like really obsessed with the wallet that may or may not be lifted from Biff, which is something my sister and I, we still will quote that whenever. Did you just take his wallet?
He took your wallet.
He just took that guy's wallet. Yeah,
I think he took his wallet.
Just repeating whatever you just said to somebody else.
Something about that.
I think he took his wallet. Like, he does it like four times.
What I like is that, like, you got room to insert a new joke. Like, you're not just sort of twisting the old jokes. You can do something. Just a little silliness for you. I know CPR. What's CPR?
All those kids are going to think it's just punching someone in the face. The CPR.
Right. Yeah, this guy showed me CPR. Let me try it on.
That's why I love this movie, is that, like, it introduces jokes like that. Or the chicken thing that it seems like permeate the entire trilogy.
Right.
But really, they are introduced here.
Yep. Like, I was convinced until just now that the chicken thing at least had some sort of call out in the first one. But I can't think of one now.
Yeah, it's just...
It's so ingrained.
Instantly iconic. Yeah. And yeah.
Takes a big movie to build on your characters, mm-hmm. and let them change. I guess he kind of changes. I don't know. I got to watch the third one again.
Boy, oh boy. The Biff's last words are great. Like, you know, we've talked about his line readings this whole episode, but that just operatic Manor. I hate Manor.
The second time in 2 days or whatever.
I know, right? I just got my car fixed.
Just got my car fixed. He didn't seem too worried about it when he was trying to run Marty over.
I know, right? The bloodlust was in him.
What kind of car is it again? That's another good line. He's like, we're in a DeLorean.
He's like a 46 Ford. He'll like rip through us like tinfoil.
Rip through us like tinfoil, yeah. I always like that one. They don't make them like that anymore.
Nope. So I've come to appreciate the setting of the third act in certain movies, how they mm-hmm. are intentionally like symbolic. Mm-hmm. So in the first movie, everything's centered around the clock, which, you know, makes sense for a time travel movie. Mm-hmm. And I think this climactic set piece is the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's a transition from like the town to an open field. It's like open expanse frontier, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Where we it's like the where bridge. We don't need roads kind of thing.
Yeah. It's the bridge from the first movie into the third movie of the frontier. And I just like that, almost or like a wormhole.
Yeah,
maybe.
Time travel itself is a tunnel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, I just I appreciated that just mm-hmm. simple, but symbolic image of a tunnel.
It's such a good tunnel too. Like I remember when I moved to LA, there are a couple tunnels that are like that. I think there's a one like downtown that has a very similar vibe, and I'm this is I like seeing this.
I think that's the one they used in The Dark Knight Rises.
And
I think the one downtown
Terminator as well is that Third Street tunnel.
Is this one in like Griffith Park?
Yeah,
or
this
something,
the
or?
One in this movie is in Griffith Park, which is actually very, very short. Mm-hmm. But what they did was they like with the lights, like those lights on the side, they don't actually exist in real life. So mm-hmm. they would put them, but they like put them very close together as like a forced perspective kind of mm-hmm. deal to make it look much longer than it was.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah. Smart. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if it was like matte painting or mm-hmm. something like that, because this is really fucking long. That editing and that like car chase part is a little sketch for me. Like, you got a long way to go in that tunnel, and he's right on your ass. Like you're not gonna make it. And then movie magic, mm-hmm. flying away, and just the climax
such a good cliffhanger. Yeah.
Oh,
great
God.
Cliffhanger.
And
the
that
mystery
always...
that is in introduced with like the shadowy figure that comes up and like the flinch that Marty has where he's like,
I got something for you.
I got something. He just digs into his coat like it's a gun. Yeah. Like, like aggressively.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Joe Flaherty, who just died.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I knew his face.
He's so funny.
Good performance.
Yeah. Like, the laugh he gives when he talks about like, the guys, we got a bet going on in the office. Guess I lost.
Yeah, it's a nice little scene stealer right there. That guy.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, the whole idea of the letter being there for 70 years, like, blew my mind mm-hmm. when I was young. Just like, oh, my God, is this really happening? Like, just the connections you make in your brain, with, like, as you realize what this implies, what it means. The fact that Doc is, like, sent a letter from... 70 years ago? Yeah, just... Mm.
There's a lot of moments in this movie that are like... I mean, the beginning, obviously, is like it picks up right where we left off. And like a lot of the time travel happens at like right at points when something else has stopped. Like, I mean, the letter is sort of an implied thing of that. Like, told you'd be here at this location at this exact minute. And then like, you know, Doc being... Hooray, we sent him off. And then Marty running around the corner.
Yeah, oh, my
like
God.
Everything just is timed just like to the point where like no one gets any rest.
That's another moment that gave me chills mm-hmm. when I was young. Just like he sends Marty back to the future. And it seems like the shot from the first movie. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like...
seamless.
It's almost like they filmed it back then.
Yep.
For Marty to come running around the corner to come and say, I'm back. I'm back from the future. And then again, like in the beginning when old Biff's like, or, you know, medium Biff, I guess, 80s Biff, is like, what the hell's going on here? Dong. The score does a mic drop.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'm back from the future. Boom. It's just like, whoa, what? It's like, it's the sound of my mind blowing.
Yeah.
I've always been really impressed by the recreations of, and like you were talking about how Zemeckis is a very meticulous filmmaker and like in recreating things, like they had to reshoot everything in the very first scene with Elizabeth Shue because she was recast from that other woman. And Claudia everything Wells. About it, the intonations that he has like Marty do, like they are spot on. Like we probably all know that movie like the back of our hand, and like doing it again in all of the high school stuff, Lorraine, because they couldn't use Crispin Glover. Like they had to get a different angle of like Lorraine talking to him with Crispin Glover behind him. Like all of that stuff is like note perfect of like how it sounded.
And it like goes out of focus the moment that like Crispin Glover should be seen. Like it, yeah, there's just such attention to the, it's, but it's seamless. It's invisible to the viewer.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that, yeah, like they recreated that last scene where he runs around the corner, like,
yeah,
they might have done too well for me as a little kid, because in that moment when I'm back from the future, I always thought, is this a different Marty? Like I'd never made the connection. I was as like
that it was him running. Yeah. There's only one man that can help me now.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, I guess I don't know who that man is.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's this Marty?
It was too much. The mechanics were too much for my little like 7-year-old brain. Like,
yeah.
But I just know it's another Marty, and Doc's got to help him.
I mean, it's a freaking complicated ass movie.
Yeah,
it is. Going back to Elizabeth Shue being in the beginning and them recreating that, the end of the first movie in which it was a different actress. Who played Jennifer?
Claudia Wells, I believe is her name.
Okay. I feel like the recast almost works in a strange way in the movie's favor about, you know, flexible timelines. It's almost like something's a little bit different. Like the past has been changed. And you know, that happened at the end of the first movie, right? Like, he kind of improves his 1985.
Right.
She has a different dad.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like a happy accident that it is what it is in the real world, like, had to be recast, but it's almost it almost works in the favor. It's like,
that's true. Yeah, the whole
the
like,
timeline is flexible. It's malleable. Everything is, you know.
My girlfriend is a more recognizable star now.
A girlfriend, a great moment. Hotter, arguably. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that.
I think I prefer part one.
Yeah.
To each their own. But Elizabeth Shue was like famous by that point.
Yeah.
I do like the moment when young Jennifer and old Jennifer see each other and it's, I'm old, I'm young,
yes,
at the same time, and they faint. They both faint.
They do that like sort of mirrored faint that's like exactly the same. Yeah, that's a good moment.
I get married at the chapel, oh love. I gotta get out of here.
And I just love how everybody's like pretty cool with the idea of like, oh, it's a time machine, got it.
Yeah.
It's like she just jumps in and it's fine. And Biff, like, it's a time machine. I know how to use this.
But
why is he all fucked up when he comes back?
Because he's old. It's hard on the body.
I guess. Like, he seems like they're, feel like there's something missing there where, like, he had a rough exit or something. But, like,
are you talking about old Biff? Drive.
Yeah.
So there is a deleted scene where he disappears. I think what happens is he writes himself out of existence.
Basically, yeah, yeah.
By going back?
Yeah, because he, like, the version of him that changed the past no longer exists because he is now the Trumpian,
the rich
Biff
guy
that never becomes the sad old Biff from that 2015.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So he wrote himself out of existence and thus, like, has a heart attack and disappears.
That's him, basically. Yeah, it's him breaking down, like, the fly. He's like,
Yeah, he's doing the Marty thing from
help
the first
me
one.
Yeah.
I get there, why there they was left like that a, out, but...
There's, like, a brief, like, 30-second deleted scene that kind of makes it more explicit, but...
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. I think that's what's going on there.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That tracks for me. Great. Thanks.
Always new things to discover in the Back to the Future trilogy.
There's so much going on.
So much. So much so that someone even wrote it down in a book form.
I wonder if there are any interesting extras in that expand on the...
Not really. So this was written, this novelization was written by Craig Shaw Gardner, who had kind of a very prominent place in this world for like a few years at the end of the 80s and the early 90s, because he did...
The novelization of movies?
Yes, exactly.
World? Okay.
Oh, it's a world I've come to know very well.
I know you.
But he did, of course, these two Back to the Future sequels, and then he did Batman 89. And yes, the Batman Returns novelization.
Returns. I read that like in the last 6 months.
Nice.
And it was delightful. I really liked his approach to writing that movie. So I'm sure this was fun.
Well, I know that Batman Returns had some co-writers too. Like the actual screenwriters were part of that. This Back to the Future is pretty straightforward as far as these things go. And kind of skews a little younger, which is interesting, because I think the movie is PG, right? If I'm not mistaken,
he swears a lot.
I know that. That's why.
For that.
That's why. Exactly. That's why. It's like, I think it is. It's still PG, even though they say shit and damn a lot. But
I mean, there's definitely way. Well, I don't know. I was gonna say there's way less sort of implied sexual content, but
right. Yeah.
There's also naked ladies in the hot tub.
So, there's know. That. Like,
what's the cutoff? I don't know.
But anyway, so I just think they're going for a younger audience. This is a kind of book with a lot of short, clipped paragraphs and like way too many exclamation marks at the end of sentences. Okay. It's like there's like one in every paragraph. So it is very tracks very closely with the movie. There is more like fun future slang in the book.
Ooh.
In that portion, especially when they get to the part with the cops and they talk about trank, like,
oh yeah,
which is the drug
that's kind of in the background. Yeah, yeah.
I was gonna bring that up. Yeah, and that's in the movie.
It's in the movie, but they talk about it more in the book, basically like painting the picture that the cops are too busy dealing with social problems like drugs to like do real police work. Like, no one does real police work anymore.
Well, they abolished all lawyers, so
yes.
Wasn't that much you can do there.
Exactly. These are words that one of the cops says to the other after the cop is like suggesting something like cutting corners, basically, in their mm-hmm. duty. Are you Kurgo? We could get our crags numped. I had to read that three times. Like, what are they saying? I still have no idea exactly what Kurgo means. But we could get our crags numped means, you know, we're going to get busted for this. Like, we're going to get taken down a peg.
I'm going to do my best to use that in a sentence this week.
Get our crags numped.
Yeah, our crags numped.
Don't get your crags numped.
It's also fun to catch, like, if you haven't like paused the movie at like the alternate newspapers and stuff to like see the other headlines. The book like writes them out, so it's easier to see things like.
I saw one that's like Nixon seeks fifth term.
Exactly. Vows to end Vietnam War by 1985.
Yeah.
So dark.
It's very, very Watchmen.
Exactly. This is the Watchmen timeline.
Right.
Yeah.
Nixon is the forever president.
It is very much like a Simpsons sign gag kind of movie.
Yep.
Especially in the future.
And also in the alternate 1985, there is a very sad scene with his brother, Marty's brother, Dave, who's just mentioned in passing in the movie, but he actually is there stumbling around in front of the Biff's pleasure paradise.
Oh, really?
And he's clearly, you know, on the drink again, and also suggests that the drinking age at some point was lowered to 14 years old, because he talks about... It's like I got you your first drink when you were 14, you know.
Oh man.
I know, it's crazy.
Too dark.
Very.
I'm pretty sure there's a sign in the movie. It's kind of obscured, but I'm pretty sure like when he walks up to the casino and the video screen, There's a sign that says smoking required.
Yes, it does.
Amazing. the attention to detail. Yes. Like,
what a world.
It's almost like Zucker Abrams level background sight gags.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that in the best way, the most like complimentary way. Like
coming in hot off of Roger Rabbit, you know. They're in that mindset.
Production design, baby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say it's you know, if you like the movie, it's kind of fun to read this, but it's not going to give you anything that the movie doesn't.
I mean, that Dave thing.
Except for that.
Yeah.
Except for a couple of small things that are just...
It's a real bummer, but yeah. I mean, it's interesting.
All right. Should we move on to our next segment, guys?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk about the future.
Yes. What are we going to do?
Or the past.
Or the past. Or a combination of both. Let's hear those pitches, man. You said a great woman, I'm in it for bitches. Simple people remake, wanna
throw me some pitches with coffin. All right, I got one. It's a little loose, especially as the further I go on, but I'm imagining a sequel. It's 2025. Our main character is Marty Jr. We can have him played by Tom Holland because he's got such Michael J. Fox energy. And he's pretty much living in our current timeline. You know, this is not the future of part two where we have flying cars. Viewers will actually recognize this as the continuation of the dystopian 1985 A timeline from the second movie. Corrupt millionaire Biff Tannen was elected president in 2016. And after doing away with the Constitution, is now serving his third term. Although I guess, you know, Nixon set that precedent in this timeline. So
sure.
That's fine. And let's make Needles his vice president.
Yes.
So the washed up Marty McFly Sr. succumbed to alcoholism, much like his mother, and died recently. A despondent Marty Jr. feels like he's living in the worst possible timeline. One night, Jr. finds his father's journal with a bunch of ramblings about time travel adventures with his old friend Doc Brown. Intrigued, Jr. follows clues from the journal, ending up at Doc's long-abandoned home, where he finds a bunch of dusty old half-finished inventions, including the brainwave analyzer that Doc wears on his head from the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Jr. puts it on and flips a switch. Suddenly, he experiences flashes of an alternate timeline, the utopian future seen in Back to the Future 2. It feels oddly familiar, oddly correct, like this is the timeline he belongs in. He tracks down the elderly Doc Brown, who has been in a mental institution for the past several decades. Doc reveals that he retooled this brainwave analyzer to receive signals from other realities, and that Junior indeed witnessed an alternate timeline. Together, they deduce that they are living in a reality that's not supposed to exist. Junior breaks Doc out. They go to find where Doc has hidden his unfinished DeLorean from this timeline in a storage unit, but it turns out that Biff discovered and stole it years ago, and that his toxic waste disposal company has been a front for hoarding plutonium to power various trips through time. The heroes then have to infiltrate the Pentagon and confront President Biff's time-traveling task force, a militarized unit that is basically the TVA from Loki.
I was going to say, big Loki vibes.
Yeah, secret agents that go and prune other timelines and ensure that all roads lead to this A timeline in which, you know, Biff is president. So this includes a lot of killing different Docs and Martys from other timelines because they're always trying to intervene and stop Biff's plans. And I imagine these agents have upgraded from DeLoreans. It's the 2020s, so let's say that Junior and Doc steal one of their time-traveling Tesla Cybertrucks. and then they're chased through different time periods. We can have fun, you know, visiting like alternate realities, other timelines. This is where I haven't quite fleshed out the rest of it, but basically Biff has gotten really good at like finding alternate ways to achieve the A timeline. So whenever, you know, Doc and Marty go back and like stop him from giving himself the almanac in 1955, he gives it to himself in the 60s. You know, there's like, he just like finds different ways to ensure that 1985 A is like the prime timeline. And so Doc and Marty Jr. basically they ensure that 2015, the utopian 2015 and beyond from Back to the Future 2 happens. And in the end, I feel like maybe they have to like go back to 1955, that nexus point of November 12th, 1955. We get like the third perspective of Marty Jr. and older Doc, like observing and like trying not to interfere with like the craziness of Back to the Future 2, ensuring that young Biff does not get the almanac. Ultimately, the end is going to be Marty Jr. and Doc arriving in the timeline that they should be in, mm-hmm. the utopian future in which Marty Sr. is alive, Michael J. Fox gets to be in it.
No makeup needed.
Yeah, no makeup needed. Crispin Glover is back. Claudia Wells is back. It's like the timeline that should be. It's like the ultimately like just fixing the timeline so that we're in the utopian future in which Biff is not president, and everything's good. So it's just kind of like one big happy ending. And to acknowledge that it starts in the A timeline, I call this Back to A Future.
Very nice.
You know, a future. The future is, yeah. It hasn't been written yet. It's whatever you make.
Exactly.
It. It's a future.
Hey, that's the next movie.
Oh, sorry. That was really good. I liked that a lot.
That was great.
I also have a idea for a contemporary set movie. So yes, also in 2025 is when mine takes place. And I was trying to think, like, what other great cinematic device, you know, with lots of weird rules and fuck it, who cares? Like time travel. Let's combine time travel with body swapping. So in this movie, we got Marty Jr. again, but also Biff the Third, I guess, with Griff, you know, the Griff that we know. But since the timeline was reset at the end of part three to basically like a more or less normal version of the 1980s, we've got Marty's son and Biff's grandson. But the twist is that the McFly is doing the bullying because their family, you know, has their experience and success. They're on the up and up, and he's bullying poor old Tannen, who's from the wrong side of the tracks, who nobody likes. And so Biff is antagonizing his grandson by telling what the youngster thinks are great big fibs about their past and like what could have been and what happened. And we can like do cutaways to numerous moments in Tannen family history. So this kid, Biff's grandson, also volunteers at the Doc Brown Institute, which has created a VR technology that combines altered modalities of consciousness across the fabric of space-time. In other words, you can literally put yourself in the shoes of other people throughout history. And through shenanigans, both the Tannen and the McFly kids find a way to use this technology to experience the events of the Back to the Future trilogy from the perspective first of their grandfathers, their own grandfathers, and then switching again to the opposite grandfathers, switching again to Marty's mother, Lorraine, and other characters across the Strickland, like just kind of just see this like constantly switching, swapping, like as they mess things up, they're like, crap, now I have to swap into Strickland to like make sure this gets fixed. Like, and as they do it,
a farce.
Exactly. As they do it, they eventually set things right, you know, back to the events of the movies that we all know. Again, with those layers that we've been talking about, we could keep observing from yet another removed layer. And so they not only do they set things right, they gain a new understanding and respect for each other, like not just because they've spent more time, but like they've literally lived their family histories together. So history is not destiny. You don't have to let the past, you know, shitty behavior define this next generations. Mostly this is about, I guess, giving any kind of hope for Biff's family.
Yeah.
And because
redeem the villain.
Exactly.
That's always fun.
Exactly. And like, you know, on the other side of the coin, like quote unquote winning in the present isn't always great because it can quickly kind of metastasize into entitlement and arrogance. You know, it's right. You got to check yourself before you wreck yourself too. Yeah. And because this is like you said, Andrew, this is kind of a redemption of the villain arc. The working title is Biff to the Future.
Yes, I had a feeling. I was going to make a Biff to the Future joke earlier in the podcast when we were talking about Biff. I love it. feels right. Yes.
I want to take the pitch time. I feel okay. So in this horrible, worst timeline that we actually live in right now, I saw
we're living a in 1985A right
yeah,
now.
We are. I saw a headline, and I have no idea if it was just a fucking AI generated bullshit, but like they were gonna make a new Back to the Future with Timothée Chalamet. And I'm just kind of against all of this on principle, but like there is such a rich sort of well of possibility. But like, oh, the original trilogy is just so like neatly tied. I think what would be interesting for me to see is moving down to this is the next episode, maybe, but Jules and Vern, Doc Brown's kids that he has when he's like fucking 80. Yeah, just raise two kids on a flying
time
train. Time train. You know, just the idea of growing up two scientists' sons, the brotherly rivalry, the shenanigans of like stealing the train and going either and growing up in the 1800s.
Or growing up in like many timelines, I feel like they would have no home. Their home is the train, which is constantly traveling through time.
Right, that's true. Yeah, and if their homestead is ostensibly the 1885 era, where they go back at night to sleep because somebody has to sleep at some point in these movies.
This is like Jack Bauer level.
Right. People. Yeah, it's just a horrible, no good, very bad day for Marty McFly. You know, moving down that generational thing, I think from Doc's offspring and timeline would be something interesting for me to see. Yeah. Doc to the Future. No, I don't know.
I like that. I do like that.
I mean, yeah, it's infinite adventures when you're traveling through time. So that's what I got. I really don't want to see a new one with Chalamet in it, though. I love Timothy. He's great. You know, he's doing good things. I just,
you know, who I thought of when I was like, I rewatched the first Back to the Future before the second one for this. You know who I was seeing in younger Christopher Lloyd, who could play maybe like Jules or Vern, is Evan Peters.
Oh,
especially like, you know, in WandaVision when he has like the wild white hair. I feel like he could pull off like Doc's kid or a younger Doc if he wanted to go there.
Yeah.
I feel like because he can have like the wild eyes. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good. I like that. And I think, yeah. I mean, playing the basically, I mean, this whole series is just like the recurring loop of basically the same story, I guess, of like fixing the sins of the father in a certain way or whatever you want to say. But like, you know, we're kind of like looping through a similar story arc each time.
Yeah. Generational.
Yeah. And I think it would be interesting to see Doc's kids like visit Doc as a kid or like as a teenager or whatever in the, what would that be? The 30s, 20s. you know, get more eras in there. More decades to explore. Yeah. Just not the 60s. We've seen the 60s enough.
I mean, I want to see like the 90s. I want to see what like the idealized, romanticized 90s would be.
That movie would be coming out like now.
I was going to say, if you think about 85 to 55, that's this. So, yeah, just modify years to from 2025 to 1995.
That's where I feel like my pitch would kind of like have fun with the decades, where it's like Biff tries it in the 60s, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. They thwart it. He tries it in the 70s. Like, you could just like go back to all these different times in which Biff tries to like get rich and famous and thwart it. And he
finally goes back to Biff as a baby, and they have to do the baby Hitler
choice.
Thing. That's what the movie is. It's finally answering the question. If you had the chance to go back in time and kill baby Hitler, would you do it? Would Doc do it? Maybe.
Well, I will say, you know, as we do these pitches, you know, Zemeckis and Gale have both been pretty straightforward about, like, they're not like the story is over. They're not entertaining any kind of sequels or reboots as long as they're alive. So as I, as right now, as I was just looking at the speculation of the Chalamet cut, I'm like, it does seem like a lot of just like hot air, people kind of wanting to will something into existence. Cause it's like, I think they've been pretty clear. They're like, no matter what, no matter how much money they're offered, like they will not give permission, you know, to do another version of this franchise. So you, but you know, people are just waiting in the wings to do it.
You never know what'll change. We got a fourth Matrix movie, and now, unfortunately, we get a fifth Matrix movie.
Do we? Is that in the works?
Yeah, you didn't see that? Drew Goddard is going to make a fifth Matrix movie, and Wachowski will executive produce.
I mean, I like him, and I didn't like the fourth one.
Oh, well, that's a whole nother podcast. You got two more hours.
It is.
I was gonna say,
we'll bring you back for that. For that,
yeah. If you revisit it,
how much longer do we have to wait till that becomes a nostalgic thing?
Another like 17 years, I think.
I'll be here.
Something's got to be done about the Matrix Resurrections. All right, back on the BTTF tip. Let's wrap up and answer that big question, guys. What were we watching?
What were we watching?
I was watching the same movie over and over again every day, and I loved every second.
So true.
I was watching the Scream 2 of the Back to the Future franchise, which is the highest compliment I could pay it. This is the snake eating its own tail, the concept deconstructed, folding in on itself in the best way, lampshading itself. It tickles my brain in so many different ways. Having fun with the future, entertaining alternate timelines, and then ultimately folding in on itself with self-reflexivity and meta-commentary. And if the first movie is all heart, this is the head. This is the heady sequel that I just love. And at any given time, the first movie could be my favorite of the trilogy or the second movie. And I feel like as of this right now moment, I'm a part two stan. I love part two. I love part two so much. The first movie is perfect, but the second movie is also perfect. And I just love it.
Agree.
They're so good and so very clever. And that's why I was watching a very clever and creative continuation of probably the best sci-fi comedy story of all time. Just so cool how they play with and expand these concepts of temporal mechanics and all the in-universe rules, and also how insane it was, the preemptive nostalgia they created for a future that never was. Like, you know, we all lived through it, the lead up to 2015 and being like, ooh, that was the Back to the Future year. Remember all that cool stuff? Wish the world was like that. So much that we tried to will it, like by creating stupid little scooters that we called hoverboards. You know, it's like, gotta make this happen. Yeah, it's just has had a much larger impact than they probably could have even imagined for a sequel to a movie that a lot of people probably thought didn't really require one.
Hey, we can tap to pay now. That was accurate.
There you go. But yes, lovely, lovely movie. And a lovely time talking about it with you, Andrew. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me to revisit it. It had been a while, and I remembered immediately why I loved that movie so much.
It's a blast. All of it. And
blast from the past.
Hey.
There's a movie on your list, maybe. Or have you done that?
Or the future. We haven't.
It is on the list.
I like that one, too.
We respect Brendan Fraser in this house, so... It's definitely on our list. But
nice.
Besides Brendan Fraser and Back to the Future, Andrew, is there anything you want to plug?
Probably I have a new Twitter handle since my last appearance. Okay. I'm at Mr. Good Posts. Mr. Good Posts now. No longer just my name. I thought it'd be better to strip some identity from that feed. So
wise.
Follow me on there. Andrew McNally on Instagram.
That's wise.
Put that one out there too.
It's wise, especially after we just totally burned the Cybertruck in this episode. Just be like,
yeah, don't thing. Come after me.
You telling me you build a time machine out of a Cybertruck?
It makes it. You can hear it in your head.
Yep.
It makes sense.
Yes.
It is the DeLorean.
It
of
is
our time.
Like I feel like both the car and
like,
the
what
man.
What the fuck am I looking at? Yeah.
Totally.
Woo.
I got behind a Cybertruck recently. I was like, "What is this?" And then I like got to the side of it. I was like, "Oh, that makes sense."
It's like Goldie Wilson got a hold of the of a regular pickup truck. Converted it.
Yeah, converted it for the future.
Well, listeners, you can also catch up with us on social media. Our handles are, you know, what were we watching? Search us either that or W4 Podcast on that Twitter. Formerly, or the,
yeah, I still say
Twitter.
I didn't even
X.
Didn't even recognize the other one. And it just occurred to me that it was just, it's still Twitter to me.
But,
sorry.
It's Twitter.
It's still Twitter to me, damn it.
Until Twitter.com does not redirect to X, right. It's Twitter. It's Twitter.
Pretty much.
We got to go back in time and change it back to Twitter.com.
So it's the URL, Marty. Something's got to be done about the URL. But, you know, what were we watching on Facebook and Instagram? And Letterboxd.
And Letterboxd.
Yep.
Nice. Oh, yeah. I'm Mr. Goodpost on Letterboxd as well.
Sweet. And there's no mailbag this episode, but if you want to drop us a line, share your Back to the Future Part 2 thoughts, we are whatwerewewatching@gmail.com. So look forward to people writing in and discussing, because
fan theories on Back to the Future 2.
Just this whole franchise. It's so much fun to talk about. All right. Well, that brings us to the end. So thanks again, listeners. And, you know, maybe we'll bump into each other sometime again in the future. Or in the past. For Cam and Andrew, I'm Eric. Thanks for listening to What Were We Watching? And until next time.
Hey, did you just take his wallet? He just took that guy's wallet.
The guy with the hat, where is he?
Oh, he went that way. I think he took your wallet. I think he took his wallet.